Срочное сообщение в эти минуты приходит из украинской столицы. Толпа
снова
радикалов,
люди в масках атакуют украинский парламент.
Ива, стрельба, взрывы и звуки сирен. Никто не ожидал, что
митинг... Поле боя между представителями свободы и правого сектора...
Видно, что возле Рады лужи крови.
Первая жертва сегодняшних беспорядков
в Киеве. Активисты радикальной партии и всеукраинского движения «Свобода».
It was the worst political violence Kyiv has seen since the Euromaidan revolution. It killed three National Guardsmen and wounded scores more. And it's raised questions about whether Ukrainian nationalist groups are out of control and risk becoming a mortal threat to the country's pro-Western authorities' efforts to establish a cohesive state and a functioning democracy. Ukraine's far right is armed and it's angry. Can it be contained? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me on the Skype line from Kyiv is Andreas Umland, a senior research fellow at the Institute for Euro-Atlantic Cooperation and editor of the academic book series Soviet and Post-Soviet Politics and Society. Welcome back, Andreas.
Hello, Brian.
And also joining us via Skype is Anton Shekhovtsov, a senior research fellow at the Legatom Institute and a leading researcher on Ukrainian nationalism and contributor to the recently published book, Eurasianism and the European Far Right. Welcome back, Anton.
Hello. Thank you.
And joining us from London also via Skype is Alexander Clarkson, a lecturer in European and International Studies at King's College London and a frequent commentator on Ukrainian affairs. Welcome to the podcast, Alex.
Hi.
All right, so by now we all know the story. Three National Guardsmen were killed, three more are in critical condition, and scores were wounded this week when nationalist protesters hurled grenades during a protest against legislation that could, and I stress could, grant greater autonomy to separatist-held areas in eastern Ukraine. Many of those participating in the violent demonstration were from the Nationalist Svoboda Party and served in volunteer battalions fighting pro-Moscow separatists in Donbass. And they feel betrayed by what they perceive as a sellout by the authorities in Kyiv. Alex, first time on the podcast means you get to get the ball rolling for us. How much of a threat is the Ukrainian far right, in your opinion? Can Kyiv contain this?
It depends on what you mean by radical right. I mean, we're dealing with a variety of different movements. You know, ideas matter. I mean, everybody keeps saying that these are cutouts or proxies, but actually ideas matter, and there are ideological differences between different movements. I mean, the people who caused the most trouble at the protest was Svoboda, and that was a party that was previously in parliament, and it's now very much on its way down. So you could see what they were doing was a kind of an act of desperation. And they also represent, at least from what I see, also in terms of the contacts they have in the diaspora, a kind of a throwback to a kind of ethno-nationalist Ukrainian identity based on language and based on a very particular Halychyna Ukrainian identity. I mean, Irina Faryon, one of their MPs, had a pretty nasty speech in the run-up to that, condemning the idea of Ukraine as a civic nation, calling it a hybrid language, a hybrid identity. I don't want this. I mean, for me, it was a little bit odd from a diasporic perspective, because this is the rhetoric I was familiar with, or I'm familiar with, in the 1980s. But this is about Svoboda. There are other groups, Azov, Right Sector. They have other agendas, and I think they're going to do different things over the next couple of years.
So the short, it's not as much of a threat as it's being blown up to be?
Well, it's not necessarily a coherent threat. I mean, you're going to have different problems from different groups. Svoboda is on its way down. If they're going to pull a stunt, I mean, they're the ones who are most in the most desperate amount of trouble. They were, so to speak, at the trough of the state. They were in considerable positions of influence and power. Now they're out, and now they're desperate. Chechny Bok wants a way back in. Pravi Sector represents a different kind of movement, though they both base themselves on, although Anton Shekhovtsov knows this a lot better than me, but base themselves on a certain kind of Banderite, Donsovist ideology. And I actually think the group that we have to watch most is Azov, because they're different. They're something new. I mean, they have their origins in groups that Anton has studied in the pre-Maidan period, but I think they've evolved into something quite distinct. And they're much strategically smarter. That doesn't mean that they're going to win elections, but they can exert a degree of cultural and ideological influence on elites, on certain sectors of Ukrainian youth, that may then influence what mainstream parties do 10, 15 years down the line. I mean, to use American political terminology, the only people capable of being the Overton window of Ukrainian politics – is Azov right now. I
and
think
they,
Pravi sector
and
for move me is
to
just,
the right, obviously.
Yeah, to the right. Pravi sector is too schlubby, right? I mean, they're of the moment, they're of now, but they're not cohesive enough, they're not centrally organized enough, they don't have a social cachet, and they have no strategy for a post-hot conflict Ukraine. I don't see private sector surviving particularly well in a Ukraine where the conflict de-escalates.
Mm. Anton, would you agree?
Well, I think there are several aspects to the story about grenade. You know, this grenade has different stories. You see, Svoboda, and Alexei is absolutely right. Svoboda is on the its support in the society is now very low, and their protest took place because they want to return to big politics. And Svoboda is trying the same trick it did in 2011, 2012. It presented itself as the most radical opposition to the authorities. But the problem is that today, to be radical is very different from being radical in 2011, 2012. Now you have a higher degree of radicalism in the society because of the war, because of the revolution. Now the most radical opposition is the right sector. If you want to be the most radical, you have to be more radical than the right sector. But then I don't believe that Svoboda's leadership planned any kind of a terrorist attack. That is absolutely obvious to me. Tarniborg and other leaders, they're not radical, actually. They're quite moderate. Tarniborg is coming because Svoboda has various ideas inside the party. Tarniborg represents a less radical, almost a moderate wing of Svoboda. The most radical wing of Svoboda is the siege battalion, also C-14 paramilitary wing, and also its youth wing called Sokol. So there you have all those radicals who go to war, who are maybe even described as neo-Nazis. So the guy who allegedly threw a grenade was coming from this most extreme wing of Svoboda that has nothing really to do with the core leadership. But this is kind of, you know, two sides of the story. Another part of the story is that Svoboda was co-organizing this protest with the radical party of Oleh Ljashko, which is a populist party, not necessarily right-wing, but just populist, and also the new party called UKROP, which stands for the Ukrainian Patriots Association, which is basically funded by the Ukrainian oligarch Ihor Kolomoyskyi.
Yeah.
And these parties, and including the radical party of Ljashko, it is also alleged of that it is funded by some oligarchical financial groups. So basically, Svoboda is now part of this trend of very anti-establishment trend, anti-governmental trend, and the forces that are benefiting from these protests are the financial groups that fear that Poroshenko could be very serious about the de-oligarchization process. They're really scared of it. So Svoboda is now playing in the hands of those people, of those old financial groups, very corrupt. So
this is a game between the oligarchs and Poroshenko. It's not really about nationalism and what it pretends to be about.
But
I think it's mostly about this power game between Poroshenko and the oligarchs. But we, of course, cannot dismiss the nationalist aspect. But we are talking here about nationalists being on the very low level with marginalized groups. They may be not successful politically, I mean, in electoral terms, but they represent the core of a possible destabilization development in Ukraine. And not only nationalist groups. If you look at the soldiers in the Ukrainian army, in the regular troops, If you look at the people who, minor officers in the army, they are also very disaffected with Prime Minister Yatsenyuk's government. And they can also be a problem. They may not be necessarily nationalist or far right, but they're kind of these disgruntled individuals. individuals in the army who feel sometimes they feel betrayed by the government.
So there's a potential for civil unrest here. If you get a lot of armed people who are disgruntled, some of whom are being manipulated by oligarchic forces, that's a deadly cocktail, no?
Yeah, absolutely.
Andreas, let's bring you in here. You've done extensive research on these far right groups. Anything you'd add here?
Well, I think that these events at the RADA may really mark a change in the position of these radical nationalists in Ukrainian politics, because earlier we had under Yanukovych and then during the Euromaidan and after the Euromaidan an alliance between the Democrats and the radical nationalists, first in the Committee Against Dictatorship under Yanukovych, then in the Euromaidan coalition, and then in the first post-Euromaidan government, Svoboda had a few ministries. I think that's now over, basically, with this confrontation. But I would also suspect that this will diminish the support for Svoboda, especially in Western Ukraine, where Svoboda had an electorate that reached deep into the mainstream of society. They had an electorate there for 30, 40, partly 50% of the population in Galicia. And I think that's now probably also going to diminish. I think very few people will have an understanding for Svoboda men or somebody linked to Svoboda killing National Guards soldiers. I agree with what was said before about Azov, that Azov is worth looking after and looking at more carefully. With a Kiev colleague of mine, Maria Bezruk, we've published probably the first deeper investigation into Azov in German recently. We are now preparing a Russian language and Ukrainian language longer text on Azov. So I think Azov is interesting, but still I don't see it as a major force yet, because it's a very small. I mean, these radical people in Azov, and one has to say that it's not the whole brigade that consists of neo-Nazis, but the neo-Nazi leadership of Azov, that's a very small circle so far. I mean, you know, these are a few dozen men, I would say, who come from the Social National Assembly, a patriot of Ukraine. Perhaps Anton knows more about their biographies. But these are, you know, I think they're scary, and what they've published before is really bad. But that's a very small group. I mean, it's not even a few hundreds. It's a few dozen men who are in control of this brigade now. I still don't think that this will have a chance to become a wider movement, although they are obviously trying to. And Bieliecki has recently actually denied his own biography. He has sort of, in an interview, alleged that the texts he had earlier published, the sort of biologically racist texts, are not his own, and that it's all a Russian conspiracy against him. So I don't see this yet as becoming actually a major political factor, although it is a very some social factor.
Alexander, you wanted to jump in here, it appeared.
I think the Svoboda is interesting. I think its archaic links go back to before 2012 anyway. I mean, there's all kinds of rumors about what they did in terms of anti-fracking protests and any number of other dubious things in West Ukraine. And they're actually more Halychina phenomenon, I always found, than anywhere else in West Ukraine. I mean, even Chernivtsi and some other Kakirovara, other parts of West Ukraine, they have actually a limited appeal. But their disappearance is opening a space. And I think it's also – that's why I'd like to come back to Azov, because I think it's about thinking – in short-term, medium-term, and long-term factors. And I completely agree with Andreas that short-term, they don't have the numbers, they don't have the reach to be an enormous force. But these are the only people, I think, on the Ukrainian right who are thinking strategically. We're thinking 3, 4, 5 steps down the line. So they have a strategy for a situation where the war de-escalates, which Pravi Sektor and Svoboda, I think, don't have. So, for example, they have these youth camps. These tabire, where you have young Ukrainians coming along and doing the Azov thing. I mean, for me, it's weird watching this. I mean, I used to go to Plast, which is Ukrainian scouting, and this is like Plast with guns, right? And they do outreach. They go to schools in Mariupol and Kharkiv, and they're sort of introduce themselves. And they do it with a kind of elitist touch, right? The pastor is the lower working class. It's schlubby. We're elite. We're something you should aspire to be. That's why they go on about NATO standards. And so, you know, they even have a civil corps, which, you know, rebuilds villages and fights fires and is generally nice to people. So I think Azov is actually the one group of people. They may fail, who are thinking, what are we doing in 2020? What are we doing in 2025? And they're using the brigade to attract recruits, not necessarily through biological racism, but to build a kind of natural national veterans organization that gives them the ability to survive when private sector and Svoboda basically go down.
What are these? What do they want? I mean, what is their goal for society? What is their political platform? Because up until now, as Andreas pointed out, we've had this alliance between the Democrats and the nationalists. What do the nationalists want other than no compromise with Russia, a Ukraine that's completely free of Russian influence? That's Ponyatna. But what do they want other than that?
Well, I think, again, ideas matter, and that's where, and ideas evolve. Maidan changes the direction certain ideas go. So you have biological racists in Azov, but if you read their VK pages, read what they've been writing, it's what Andrew Wilson would have called Kievocentric imperialism, right? It's a very, very nifty trick. It basically says, yeah, Kiev is the mother of all Russian cities, but if Kiev is the mother of all Russian cities, Kiev should rule Russia. Or European Russia. And, you know, let's leave all the Eurasian Russian Mongol horde in Moscow to Kazan and places like that. That appeals to Russian nationalists, right? And, you know, in this kind of meld of ideas, you can pick and choose. If you're not a biological racist, you can go with that, right? If you're Kievocentric. If you believe in militarism and strength and authority in the Hetmanate, you know, we elect somebody, but that boss is then, in terms of democratic centralism, an old Leninist term, he runs things as a strong fist and forget parliamentarianism and all the rest. Yeah, there's that. So you can pick and choose from your agenda. What they want to do in future, maybe Andreas better understands. I'm just looking at what they're doing and how now and how they're pitching it to Canadian Ukrainians or German Ukrainians, because they're trying to pitch this to a wider audience as well.
Anton, do they have the ability to undermine the state? I mean, or is this just a marginal threat, really? I mean, I'm really trying to drive, because, yeah, right-wing groups everywhere have their wacky ideas. I mean, you could find it in any Western European country, in the U.S. and Canada. This segment exists in Western society. What's a little bit frightening in Ukraine is you have this state that's trying to build itself and establish a new functioning democracy. You have these guys, they're armed, they're battle-hardened, they have ideas. How much of a threat is this?
I think that discussing their ideas is only one possible approach to them. But I would also focus equally on the organizational and on the other covert links between the mainstream and the far right. So, for example, look at the Azov. Azov was created by the organization called Patriot of Ukraine. Patriot of Ukraine was born in the noughties in Kharkiv, and as far as I understand, already then the Patriot of Ukraine and its leader Andriy Beletsky, they were cooperating with Arsen Avakov, the Minister of Internal Affairs. So Azov became, as I believe, Avakov's private army. So if everything goes fine with Avakov, and he's part of the elite, and he's not threatened by anyone else, then Azov will be controlled, will stay under the control. And with the right sector, it is a bit different. The right sector does not have many links to the establishment and to the, you know, to the mainstream elites in Ukraine. But the right sector is also part of a huge network of, I would say, you know, quite dodgy business. And we must not forget that Ukraine remains a very corrupt country. So I would not believe that it would be possible to exert influence on the Ukrainian mainstream and change it in the nationalist direction by the far-right groups. If they go closer to the mainstream, to the center, they would be losing their nationalist attitudes, they would be losing their nationalist sentiments. And The Azov case is quite revealing in this sense, because now they deny basically the text that they wrote a few years ago. And this means that they understand that they cannot build their future, political or bureaucratic or any other future, by drawing on some biological racist stuff.
Yeah,
it just
exactly.
does not work in the Ukrainian society.
Yeah, yeah.
So I would agree with Alex that Azov is quite smart. But at the same time, if you look at, again, at their activities, kind of, you know, doing the firearms and talking to school children and to students, this reminds very much of the approach of the new police. It's kind of, you know, mm-hmm. friendly people who you can trust. And this, I think, is Avakov's initiative.
Mm.
Okay, so Azov is kind of frightening to some, but let's make them nice-looking guys.
So it's marketing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's absolutely marketing. Look at the new police. It's the same approach. Azov is doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. They want to look respectable, although they will never, obviously, get away with the symbolism that they have. But this can be changed.
Now, Anton, you had a very memorable post on Facebook last, memorable to me at least, because I made a note to myself to mention it, back when the last big incident involving the Ukrainian right, the shootout involving Right Sector in Transcarpathia, you wrote that Right Sector, when looking at Right Sector, remember that it's not McDonald's, it's sushi. Do you remember the post I'm talking about, where you said it's not one thing, it's not a franchise that's centrally controlled and has one standard of quality. It's different everywhere. Can you expand on that a little bit? Because I found that really intriguing and interesting.
You see, after the revolution, the Right Sector became quite popular. So basically, some of the groups, far-right groups, nationalist groups all over Ukraine, they wanted to be part of this popularity, part of this success. And they just started calling themselves, say, a branch of the Right Sector. So what they would do, they would send one representative of their group to Kiev to meet with the leadership of the Right Sector and in Kiev. And then the leadership would say, yeah, it's fine. So you can call yourself the Right Sector too. But there was no real control over the people who were in various places all over Ukraine. So they could do whatever they liked. And basically some of the criminal groups connected to real organized crime, they understood that calling themselves the Right Sector might be a good move that would legitimize their criminal activity. So what we saw in Transcarpathia, in Mukachevo, we saw a clear example of an organized crime group that started calling themselves the Right Sector just to have it as a cover for their illegal activity. So yes, this is sushi. This is not McDonald's that controls every restaurant on the planet Earth. This is something that you cannot control, and this just depends on who exactly constitute a core of any particular Right Sector branch wherever.
So what I'm hearing here, I mean, just judging from the conversation so far, is we don't have a coherent ideological threat. We don't even seem to have a coherent threat of civil unrest. We have a bunch of different groups with different ideologies, all of which can be lumped in on the far right, being manipulated and used and using and manipulating themselves, other groups in society, whether they be oligarchs, whether it be organized crime groups, some overlap among the two, whether it be the government itself. So it doesn't, this doesn't seem to me to be the threat it's cracked up to be. Andreas, am I wrong?
No, I think you're right. And I think there is an ultra-nationalist potential in Ukraine, but it reminds me a little bit of Russia in the 1990s when there was a split between the different nationalist groups, and that was then a problem for the whole ultra-nationalist movement, although I think the potential is altogether much lower in Ukraine still today than it is in Russia. Concerning Azov, I agree with Alex that they've been very well organized. They also have a good fighting record. The brigade is said to be disciplined in distinction to other nationalist units, and they're trying to make a good impression with some success during the last 1.5 years, and they've also made it into parliament, two of their representatives, Bilecki and Ihor Mosichuk, if you still count him as being linked to Azov, then they are represented in parliament now. But on the other hand, I think they are haunted by their past. I mean, both by these really biologically racist texts where they talk about Aryans and all these things, quite radical. The most radical texts I've seen so far published in post-Soviet Ukraine, and also this link with Avakov that Anton mentioned. I think if now Avakov, he had always a tense relationship with the right sector. Now Avakov is also getting into a major conflict with Svoboda, and but Azov has this historical link to Avakov. So this is all, you know, it's all a problem. You know, it's very contradictory, and Azov would have to go through a change like Svoboda in 2004 to get rid of its past, basically, of its symbols, and to really remake itself fundamentally in order to become acceptable to wider society.
Alex, come in.
I agree with Anton and Andreas, but we have to think in terms of short-run, medium-term, and long-term effects. And I think one of the problems I find, possibly as a historian, looking at these debates about the DNR, LNR, about the Ukraine, about Russia, is we're fixated on what's happening in 6 or 7 or 8 months down the line, and we're not thinking about how these worldviews and mindsets might ingrain themselves in parts of the Ukrainian society, particularly parts of the security structure, in a long-term sense. It may be that these groups don't win anything and don't do well, but it could be that as their men filter through the Ukrainian security establishment, they embed a certain way of looking at the world, a certain way of behaving, a certain whatever-it-takes mentality, which is very dangerous for Ukrainian democracy, not in the sense that they would show up and topple the parliament, but a certain set of behaviors, a professional behaviors, you know, but a certain set of behaviors in a very strong or very professional Ukrainian army could still not pay attention to human rights, mm-hmm. could still ignore democratic accountability, could decide when the power balance between Russia and Ukraine shifts that maybe destabilizing bits of Russia is a good thing to do. It would be an appalling thing to do, but that's the kind of mentality that may filter with these angry and disaffected and non-political officers looking to groups like Azov. They may not, again, push a coup when they're lieutenants, but when they're majors, when they're colonels, when they filter through 10, 15 years down the line, we have to hope that their mindset fits a democratic system and society, and that their mindset hasn't taken any of these ideologies at face value and absorbed certain behaviors. So I think the threat in Ukraine isn't so much the Russian option, I don't know how best to describe the Likud option, right? That you don't end up with a Putin or a Mussolini, you end up with Ariel Sharon, right? Who can operate in a democracy but will do whatever it takes.
Yeah, that's not so bad. I mean, I
think a lot of Lebanese would.
Let's leave that aside. But I mean, in terms of the internal development, whatever one thinks of Ariel Sharon, he functioned in an Israeli democracy by the rules, pretty much.
Well, he broke all the rules when they invaded Lebanon. What I'm saying is that's a kind of mentality that can be very dangerous to democracy in a more corrosive sense, not in the direct sense that we're looking at 6 months down the line.
Anton, would you agree with that? Is that the biggest threat coming out of this? Because that sounds like – it sounds to me like Alex hit it pretty much on the head here. This is the long-term threat, I think, no?
You see, we don't have many details about the nature of cooperation between the Patriots of Ukraine that became Azov and Arsen Avakov. And we also know very little about the biography of Andriy Bilecki.
Yes.
Exactly. When he became a commander of the Azov battalion in May last year, he became, a lieutenant colonel within the Ministry of Internal Affairs. But I would speculate that the Patriot of Ukraine in Kharkiv was a police control organization that was created in order to keep the loonies basically under control. If you look at the activities of the Patriot of Ukraine, They were very rarely involved in like real violent activities. They were quite extreme ideologically always. Andreas is absolutely correct. They're biological racists, basically neo-Nazis. But what if the Patriot of Ukraine was indeed this police control organization? It's nothing new. These organizations, they existed in the past, they exist now. So what if this ideology and these all this imagery is a way to involve young people with maybe far-right views and basically keep them under control?
Well, this leads to the issue, because that's one, what you're talking about here is the hand of Kyiv, so to speak, right? In this,
yeah, absolutely, the hand of Kyiv, yes. And I presume that these security services all over Europe sometimes do these things.
Yes, and there's one security service that's located a bit north of Kyiv that does it quite well. And this is something I wanted to get at, because I honestly don't know the answer to this question, but. If you look at the Russian media now, they're having a field day with this. They're having a field day with this. See, we told you the place is filled with Banderovtsi and neo-Nazis. So this plays into Moscow's hands in a PR sense. But it also made me ask the question, is there a hand of Moscow in here? Because we know the KGB's standard operating procedure was to create groups like this. In Soviet times and use them to their advantage for whatever purposes. Is it possible? Because I don't know. I've seen no evidence of this. I saw President Poroshenko earlier this week blame the violence in front of the Rada on a Russian provocation. I saw this in an interview he gave to Sky News. He wasn't very specific about that. This fits the kind of, and it's one thing a lot of journalists like myself are wondering about, the level of infiltration into far-right groups that Moscow has. Is that something that's just completely off the mark, or is there cause for concern there? Anybody feel free to jump in.
Well, go. I would argue that all the far-right groups in Ukraine, especially the more significant ones like the right sector, Azov, Svoboda, they all infiltrated by various security services.
Including
the Russian and Ukrainian. The question is, what is the level of the Ukraine? Ukrainian infiltration, you know, by the security services. What's the level of the Russian infiltration? I would say that the level of the Russian infiltration is quite low. I don't think that probably they just have informers among the rank and file, but not they're not able to influence the decision. So the infiltration is obvious. I mean, I would do this, and I'm sure that Moscow understands that it is very important to do this. But I would not exaggerate this. I would not treat it as something, you know, dramatic.
Could they pull off a provocation, like, for example, throwing a grenade at National Guardsmen in front of the parliament?
No, I don't think so. Because, you know, it's just the Occam's razor. I know that people in Ukraine, some people in Ukraine are disaffected, alienated, they feel betrayed, and these are genuine sentiments. Mm-hmm. So I would totally understand if it turned out that indeed there was this guy from Svoboda, from a unit, Sich, that was so depressed that he decided to start a personal war against the government. So why would I start suspecting the Moscow's hand if the internal developments can easily explain the situation? Mm-hmm.
Andreas, Alexander, would either of you agree or disagree with that?
Yes, I agree with what Anton said. I also think there is there's too much conspirology here around. To blame everything on Moscow. I mean, lots of things that have gone wrong in Ukrainian history have to do with Moscow. Maybe most things even, but not everything. I mean, and that is something that Ukraine has to come to terms with also, that you cannot simply always blame Moscow for everything, and that is one of the problems. And I mean, there were warnings in 2012 when this committee against dictatorship was created and Svoboda was included. There was an open letter by scholars who were studying Ukrainian nationalism and who were warning against Svoboda's the cooperation with Svoboda, and now that's how we got there. And but I also think that that might be the end of Svoboda as a nationally significant party. They will try to turn this around maybe and reinterpret all that. But it will be very difficult for them to get away from responsibility for these three dead soldiers.
Okay, and that's a very sobering note to segue into the second half. In a few moments, we will continue our discussion and look at the issue that sparked this week's violence in Kyiv. If and how the separatist-controlled areas of Donbas will be reintegrated into Ukraine. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power of the Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Kyiv is Andreas Umland, a senior research fellow at the Institute for Euro-Atlantic Cooperation and editor of the academic book series Soviet and Post-Soviet Politics and Society. Also joining us via Skype is Anton Shekhovtsov, a visiting senior fellow at the Legatham Institute, a leading researcher on Ukrainian nationalism, and a contributor to the recently published book, Eurasianism and the European Far Right. And joining us from London is Alexander Clarkson, a lecturer in European International Studies at King's College London, and a frequent commentator on Ukrainian affairs. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Конституции Украины не будет нормы об особом статусе Донбасса.
Это исключено. Они будут пытаться разрушить Россию.
Условия, на которых Донбасс готов остаться в составе Украины.
Донбасс сегодня отреагировали на заявление президента Украины.
Киев обязан прислушаться к условиям Донбасса.
Что Донбасс – это часть Украины.
Now, this week's violence, of course, took place in a context. The context of Ukraine trying to fill its obligations under the much maligned and often violated Minsk ceasefire agreement. According to that agreement, Ukraine is obliged to reform its constitution to give more power to its regions, which almost everybody thinks is a pretty good idea. But Kyiv is also obliged to grant the separatist-held areas of Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts a vaguely defined special status, which makes a lot of Ukrainians nervous about Moscow using the territories as a Trojan horse. It seems to me, though, that the government in Kyiv is slow-walking the status of the separatist territories. The initial legislation has passed the Rada, but the supermajority to get it enshrined in the Constitution appears not to be there. And President Petro Poroshenko has indicated that the matter won't even come up for a vote until all the Russian troops have left Donbas, the separatists have disarmed, and Ukraine has given back control of its border. Russia, meanwhile, appears to be moving towards a soft annexation of the territories. It's making noises about issuing passports in the so-called DNR and LNR. And the LNR has started using the ruble as its official main currency. And the separatists are planning a referendum on joining Russia in October and November. It seems to me it's very obvious where this is heading. It's obvious. It's headed to, it's been said a billion times, a frozen conflict, a Russian protectorate, whatever the hell you want to call it. Perhaps annexation, soft annexation, as I called it in my blog here. But that seems to me to be the only place this can go. Am I wrong, Andreas?
Well, I mean, yes, it would be the sort of thing one would expect. The only problem here is with that. That this would not be an implementation of the Minsk agreement.
No.
In purely sort of formal terms, it would mean that the current sanctions should stay in place.
Which they would.
And well, I'm not so sure. I mean, maybe there might be then some rethinking when the fighting actually stops, and there might be then voices in the European Union especially, which will argue for lifting at least some of the sanctions. But I think the crucial point in all of this are the sanctions, because this whole nervousness in Ukraine is partly not understandable for me, because if indeed the whole decentralization process does not lead to a restoration of control, of Kyiv's control over the occupied territories, then the sanctions should stay in place, and then we will basically stay with the status quo. And therefore, I think this whole conflict in front of the Rada and within the parliament, also within the government coalition, is somewhat not understandable for me, because I think the West will understand a fake implementation of the Minsk agreement, and I think the distrust towards Putin now is sufficiently high that there will be no acceptance for some sort of only a theater of an implementation of the Minsk agreement, and therefore the sanctions will not be lowered, and therefore we will basically stay at the current situation if Moscow does not really implement in substance the Minsk agreement.
Well, the thing that, I mean, actually, my feeling on this right now is that Poroshenko has played a very, very bad hand. I think masterfully. I mean, I think he's played he was dealt a bad hand with the Minsk agreement, basically. And everybody's biggest fear was that these territories are eventually going to be reintegrated back into Ukraine as a fifth column, as a Trojan horse, with the current separatist leadership being its legitimate government, the current separatist fighters being its militia. And when you would have a Ukraine that's decentralized to the point of dysfunction, which is precisely what Moscow wanted. And thinking back to February, I was looking at this like, my God, how are they going to get out of this? So the best case scenario for Ukraine, of course, reintegration of these territories with the border back under their control, under Kyiv's control, with where they're just another region of Ukraine. That ain't happening, right? But what's also not happening is what Russia wants, because Russia doesn't want these territories. I'm convinced they don't want these territories as a protectorate. I think we're getting this scenario where at least the rest of Ukraine now will have a chance to move on and to implement its pro-Western reforms. Go ahead, Alex.
I think that there's two variables that aren't given enough consideration. So in strategic terms, in elite geopolitical terms, I think you're right. I think a frozen conflict scenario is Ukraine not losing, which is in effect, in its own odd way, a victory. But there's two variables to be kept in mind. One for Ukraine, and they're not discussed enough, is the IDPs. You have 1 million internally displaced persons. Now, frozen conflicts, ones that actually enable countries to develop separately, can last a very long time. Look at Cyprus. Look at Kashmir. That's 70 years ago, and it's still ongoing. How do you explain to 1 million people, many of them pro-Ukrainian, that they're not going home? Right? That's going to cause significant pressures in Ukrainian politics if handled badly. The pressures for Russia we have to keep in mind is that Moscow has been terrible at building governance structures in the DNR and the LNR. Right? So whenever there's been an extended period of quiet on the front, immediately the various factions of the DNR and LNR are at each other's throats. And that instability doesn't just stay in Donetsk and Luhansk. It doesn't really hit Ukraine because you have a front line. It blowbacks into Rostov Oblast.
Mm-hmm. And it already is blowbacking into Rostov Oblast.
Yeah, it bleeds in together with all kinds of problems in the North Caucasus, right? So Russia has a whole set of practical problems and destabilizing elements here. These are two variables that could upend both Putin's, well, Putin's calculations have been upended anyway, but, you know, his successor's calculations, 10, 15, 20 years down the line. And the IDP issue really has to be handled. It's also the reason why Russia cannot fulfill the Minsk Accords. If those 1 million people come back, and a significant number of them are pro-Ukrainian, whatever Bosnia plan Russia has for Donetsk, and because you have a significant number of people there who aren't pro-Russian. Right? So, I mean, the whole IDP issue is a huge one for Ukraine. And I'm wishing Poroshenko, Yatsenyuk, Yarosko, somebody would grapple with that. Because if this is frozen permanently, somebody has to do something or talk to these people and explain to them that they're not going home.
And make arrangements for them to have a new home inside of a new Ukraine, one would assume.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
Anton, what are your thoughts on the endgame here?
They were interesting. Maybe I could add something. There were interesting leaks. Very recent leaks from the security service of the Donetsk People Republic, published by the Anonymous International. And the information dates back to the end of 2014, beginning of 2015, and there were internal public opinion polls. And those results, they revealed that in the Donetsk People Republic, the percentage of people who are pro-Russian or, you know, pro-DNR are around 15%. 15? 15.
Uh-huh.
And the percentage of the pro-Ukrainian population is from 10 to 15. So basically, the majority of people, they just don't care under what flag they would live. But those public opinion polls also registered a certain panic in those societies in the occupied territories. I think that overall, if nothing changes, if we have this hybrid peace as part of the hybrid warfare, then time plays to the benefit of Ukraine. If sanctions stay in place, then we just have to wait till the Russians change their attitude. And I don't think that we can discuss anything about the occupied territories in eastern Ukraine unless Russia changes its behavior. I mean, it's useless because it all depends on Russia, on its tactics, on its manipulations and various other things, what right. they want. Because Ukraine is completely dependent. It cannot compete militarily with Russia, obviously. So we just have to wait.
The thing is, Northern Cyprus shows that you can have a democratic transition and democratic successor governments, this is in the Turkish case, still have to hold on to the hybrid territory because it's become too much of an aspect of elite prestige and identity.
Well, we right. saw this from the Yeltsin to Putin in the opposite direction in terms of democracy, not democracy, with Abkhazia, South Ossetia, and Transnistria. And so yeah, I would expect. I don't expect, as somebody that watches Russia for a living more than Ukraine, I don't expect any change of behavior out of Moscow under this regime and potentially under the next regime. Because as Gleb Pavlovsky put it so eloquently, when this regime falls, it'll fall in one day and be replaced by something exactly like it. Andreas, what are your thoughts on the end game?
Well, I think the problems that Russia is having are accumulating. And I think what Putin has been doing over the last 15 years in Chechnya, in Georgia, in Ukraine, I think that was all sort of under conditions of a relatively good economic situation. So I'm not sure. I wouldn't extrapolate the developments of the last 15 years in the future, because when the economy is in trouble and when there's no solution in sight, I think the whole sort of system of coordinates is changing. And I would be rather optimistic here, because what many people fear, that Russia could become then fascist when Putin falls or something like that. I mean, maybe there could be with Shoigu or with somebody like that, just a continuation of the Putin-style regime, but that wouldn't solve anything. But a radicalization of the regime, becoming even more nationalistic, wouldn't be a solution to the economic problem. Hitler...
No, it would make it worse.
And Hitler built his regime when Germany was, first of all, a major economic, technological, scientific power in the world, and it was also, the economy was rising anyway, and it just went through a deep crisis, and the economy was picking up again, and that was then the background for his rise and for his confrontational policies. With a declining Russia, to have an ultra-nationalist in power, I think the price would be just too high. And I think the Russians are basically too modern, too much used to more or less acceptable living standards to buy all these things and to do some sort of neo-imperial restoration. I think that's basically the days of Putin and of this whole regime are numbered.
Yeah, no, Alex, was that you wanting to jump in?
Yeah, I think I agree. But maybe it's the perspective of the historian. You know, we always expect this to happen tomorrow. And what I find so interesting in a lot of the political science writing about Russia and Ukraine is that there is a kind of a short-termist approach saying this is going to happen next week, tomorrow. The Putin regime will fall. I mean, I agree with that. But it may fall next year, 2 years, 3 years down the line. That's a lot of time to do damage.
I think it's probably going to make it at least till 2018.
Yeah.
If it falls,
And there are all kinds of variables at that point that we won't be aware of. So I think I'd be very, very careful about exactly predicting where that regime is going to go. And I think there's also a number of issues with the state monopoly of violence, how that's eroding, which mean, yeah, I probably agree with Andreas. There's a liberal outcome, a more democratic outcome is more likely. But getting there is going to involve potentially rebuilding of the state that we're familiar with because we're discussing Ukraine here.
Yeah. No, I mean
by when saying that Putin's days are numbered, I didn't mean days in a neutral. I mean that I would also say something like within the next 5 years, we will probably be see some fundamental change. But of course, they have reserves and they are also smart. At least parts of the leadership are smart. Some of the political technologists are smart. So they will come up with certain temporary solutions. But they cannot solve the fundamental problems of the Russian economy.
Right. Coming back to Minsk, I mean, would everybody agree with me that Poroshenko has unexpectedly, because this surprised me, played a bad hand extremely well here? Because I didn't see this coming. Anybody, Anton, what do you think? It strikes me as just the way he slow walked this whole decentralization thing, just to the point, and then convincing Merkel and Hollande especially that this is enough for me to be fulfilling my obligations under Minsk, which Merkel and Hollande seemed to agree with during their meeting with Poroshenko in Berlin on the 24th. That seemed to have been a breakthrough, actually. But he's played this really well, and he seems to have boxed Putin into a corner. I never thought I'd see this happen. Am I missing something, or am I right?
I totally agree with you, and I do not share fears of some of the elements of the Ukrainian society keeping saying that this is all betrayal. No, I think that's a smart move on his part, on the part of his government. And what he basically says is that there will be no decentralization until Kyiv has full control over the territory, which means that decentralization works only for Ukraine, and it will not allow for this infiltration for this Trojan horse inside Ukraine. And so even with those elections that they are planning to hold in these strange republics, in the occupied territories in October this year, I mean, if they hold elections, it is very likely that the US and the EU will increase sanctions.
Mm-hmm. Not to mention a referendum on joining Russia.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the problem with Poroshenko, though, is that it is his policies, his decisions have very bad informational support in Ukraine. So basically, he's doing the right things most of the time in these extremely grave situations, but it does not provide the coverage why he's doing this. For example, he talked about this decentralization and these changes about the institution after the protests and after three people were killed.
Mm-hmm.
Why not do this before everything like this? Why not, you know, just to support your policies with explanations?
I think,
and there is this shortage, this lack of explanation.
I think part of the problem there is that what he's doing, he has to kind of do what he's truly doing. What I think he's truly doing is he has to do stealthily, because him calling Putin's bluff on this is predicated on him being ready. And I think he is. Maybe the three of you may disagree with me. I think he is ready to get to cede these territories before he would let them back into Ukraine as a Trojan horse. Right. If those are the two choices, I think he's prepared to cede them. But no Ukrainian president could say he's going to cede this territory. So he has to be very careful how he frames this to the public and to the wider global audience. So I think that might be one of the explanations. Andreas, Alex, what do you have any thoughts on this?
I think, first of all, it's a team effort. I think, you know, the Anaconda plan that basically is throttling the DNR and LNR, the occupied territories economically, is Turchinov's plan. I think Klimkin, the foreign minister Klimkin, if you talk to people in Berlin, he deserves a lot of credit. I mean, he was the ambassador in Berlin beforehand, and he knows the German political scene very well. He knows the weaknesses of the SPD. He knows that, you know, hammering the Germans for, you know, Bankefrau Ribbentrop and all that Twitter nonsense that we had a year ago, that's dumb. You need to speak to the SPD really from the bottom up. He's a very smart guy. And so I don't think Poroshenko deserves all the credit or a huge amount of credit, actually. This is a consensus of the Ukraine.
When I said Poroshenko, I was speaking in terms of Ukraine has played.
This matters in terms of domestic politics. I think Poroshenko may go down as somebody who did the right thing, but other people will get credit for it down the line.
Mm-hmm. Andreas, any last thoughts before we wrap up? I'm looking at the clock and seeing we're bumping up against it now.
Yeah, maybe going a little bit above or outside of what you've been asking, What I hear often in Ukraine is this fear that once the occupied territories return into the Ukrainian state fully, they will become a black hole for the for Ukrainian funds and for the budget and so on. But I think one should not underestimate that probably if indeed the Donbas returns fully to under Kiev control, my feeling is that there would be lots of international organizations that would be coming and that would be providing funds and would be coming in and helping Ukraine. I mean, that's a slightly speculative forecast, but my feeling is that in such sort of crucial situations, there is then a mobilization of the international community, both of public organizations and also of private organizations that understand the complications of such a step and that would then provide help. And then maybe actually the Donbas could be rebuilt with the returning refugees and with the funding coming in from various Western development organizations.
Well, that's a good optimistic note to wrap it up on. Yeah, Putin wanted to turn Ukraine into Bosnia, but he has certainly failed in that effort. Well, that's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Kyiv has been Andreas Umland, a senior research fellow at the Institute for Euro-Atlantic Cooperation and editor of the academic book series Soviet and Post-Soviet Politics and Society. Also joining us via Skype has been Anton Shekhovtsov, a visiting senior fellow at the Legatom Institute, a leading researcher on Ukrainian nationalism, and a contributor to the recently published book Eurasianism and the European Far Right. And joining us from London, also via Skype, has been Alexander Clarkson, a lecturer in European and International Studies at King's College London and a frequent commentator on Ukrainian affairs. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Kancheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable and totally awesome Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.